Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, September 17th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live at our new times from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on drsaputo.com and prn.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 20 to the hour. And we got a great show for you today that's going to include how important is vitamin D in critical kids who have illness in the ICU.
And acupuncture is nixed by mainstream medicine.
And how can you eat a high-fat diet and still prevent obesity?
How prescription happy is the United States?
And is it safe to use NSAIDs if you've had a heart attack or, for that matter, if you haven't?
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. We need vitamin D, the sunshine vitamin, for more than just healthy bones. Besides lowering the risk for cancer, heart attacks, strokes, hypertension, and the list goes on, now medical researchers have found that 3 out of 4 children in the intensive care unit are deficient in vitamin D. So let's talk about this Canadian study and its implications.
Right. They did this on about 300 kids, okay? And these were all children that were in the ICU. And like Vicki said, 75% of them had levels of vitamin D that were below what you'd expect to see. They were sicker, had more support for maintaining their life, and they were in ICU for a longer time.
By support, you mean the tubes, lots of tubes.
Yeah,
like breathing
the life
tubes
support systems that they have in ICU. So what we're looking at here is an epidemic and, of course, a vitamin D deficiency. But, of course, you're talking about, in general, there's an epidemic of vitamin D deficiency. But when you have kids that are sick, they're not getting out in the sun much. And you know, those UVB rays are only there between about 10 and 2. And so if you don't get out in the sunlight, you're not going to get vitamin D because it doesn't go through glass.
And many times parents think they're doing the right thing to cover their children up and slather them in sunscreen. And they really are needing at least 20 minutes a day of the sunshine vitamin. And if you have dark skin, you need longer than that.
You may need 45 minutes.
So. You don't want them to burn, but it's healthy to get some sun.
I think what this is it's a reflection of how nutrition is underappreciated in people who are sick, particularly those that are in the hospital or in the intensive care unit or the CCU, because our nutritional needs go up. We're not talking about just the minimum daily requirements, the RDAs that everybody's talking about. When you're in the ICU, your demands for vitamins and minerals and nutrients go way up. And so if you don't provide those, you simply can't make the products that you need to be able to boost your immune system and to be able to function normally.
And we also know that vitamin D helps to lower the risk of respiratory illnesses.
Well, it does a lot in that way. If you have a cold or asthma or lung disease of some kind and you don't have enough vitamin D, you simply can't repair those surfaces in the lung that need vitamin D in order to be able to repair themselves. So it's a really important vitamin from that point of view.
Do you think doctors should be routinely checking kids for their vitamin D levels or just when they're sick?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, when you have an epidemic like this and it's so common, we definitely should be doing that. I always use that as a routine part of everybody that I see in my practice.
But you see adults, though.
Well, mostly, but I see some kids, too, depending on what kinds of problems they have.
Right.
You know, if kids have things that are related to bowel disorders, we do an awful lot of that kind of work, like IBS in kids or chronic diseases in kids. So what vitamin D does is it basically boosts immunity by regulating the T cells in our body. Those are the cells that fight against chronic diseases and provide protection against cancer. It's what kills the microbes that are in our body when we're ill. It's also important in autoimmune diseases because if you have a tendency for the body to make more antibodies than it makes cells that fight against microbes, you're going to have a problem with an increased risk of autoimmunity. So in people who have autoimmune disease, it's vital that we take vitamin D even in larger amounts than normal. I'll sometimes push people even into the toxic range in order to avoid that they have this problem of making too many antibodies that can even go ahead and start attacking your own body.
You know, the other thing I was thinking of that we haven't mentioned yet is that vitamin D is good for diabetes. And we have such an epidemic of diabetes in children now. And so some of those children are ending up in the intensive care unit as well.
Well, it does a lot of other things to our body that are a disaster if we don't have enough of it. It'll wind up giving you hypertension and heart attacks and strokes and cancer. It's not just for bones, like you've said earlier. So we have to do something to pay attention to this, because this article that was published in the journal Pediatrics just in the last week or two really drove home the point that vitamin D in people who are sick is an even bigger problem than in people who are that are well that have low levels of vitamin D.
You know, with so much incidence now of these methicillin-resistant Staph aureus infections, the MRSA and the C. difficile, do you think vitamin D would help to lower that risk or to prevent that?
There isn't any question that would boost immunity, but it would also take care of repairing the intestinal tract. You know, in people like that, what you see is a leaky gut syndrome, where the pores in the intestinal tract are too high, and when they're too big, what happens is a lot of the microbes that live in the intestinal tract can pass across from inside of the body, or from inside of the gut to the inside of the body. It also can cause all kinds of large molecules to come into the body that shouldn't, because when the pores are big, they don't get filtered out so much. And that sets the stage for creating autoimmunity, like we were talking about earlier. And if you don't have enough vitamin D, you cannot repair the gut.
Could you get peritonitis from that?
Yes, you can.
That's what happens when an appendix ruptures. You can get peritonitis.
You can get peritonitis in different ways. But in people who have had surgical operations, for example, if you feed them too soon, it becomes a real problem. So the whole business of making sure you have vitamin D, making sure you don't have leaky gut syndrome, is a real problem.
When we were kids, our parents used to give us cod liver oil because that was high in vitamin D, besides the fact that it was a fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be another way, I guess, to get this into these kids.
Well, you get a little vitamin A that way, and you also get the essential fatty acids, which kids need to have too. In fact, mothers should probably be taking that prior to the time they're getting pregnant, because if our levels are low, we simply don't have enough of those essential fatty acids that our babies need to build healthy brains, and they wind up with lower IQs than from mothers who have been taking it.
You know, the recommended dietary allowance, the RDA, I guess doesn't mean very much really, when you think about it, especially in sick children or sick adults for that matter.
Well, you're talking about the amount that might be used to prevent pellagra or scurvy or something like that. And what we need is optimal biochemistry. We have to be able to fight infection. We have to be able to make sure that we can detoxify. And if we don't have enough of all the things that we need at a time when demands are high because we're sick, you're not going to get well. So you wonder why training for doctors isn't different.
This is great news, though, that the doctors are going to be more aware now to check vitamin D levels and to restore them as soon as possible, particularly when these children are admitted to the intensive care unit.
Well, it's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, look what we do. We wind up giving them sugar water, you know, when they're in the hospital as a IV fluid. And sometimes we add a few nutrients to it, maybe something that has a few vitamins and minerals, but nothing like the massive amounts that we want. The empty calories that are provided in sugar water that doesn't have the raw materials that you need to make the products to fight the disease cause a real major issue. And when that happens, you just can't make what you don't have. You can't make it out of thin air. So if you're short any vitamin, mineral, or nutrient that the body needs, it's like trying to build a car and being short a steering wheel or a spark plug or some other thing that you need to build a car. Nutrition's no different. And there's a whole range between what's optimal and what you can get away with in a minimal sort of way before you even know that that's a problem, because our bodies are so amazing that they have this reserve that allows it to be able to protect itself before you start having symptoms. And when you use up that buffer, that wellness buffer, you got problems. Then you start having problems with disease, or not being able to recover from it, or just being sick for a long time. We see that a lot because doctors simply don't have the backgrounds that they need in nutrition. And our dietitians don't understand medical nutrition. What they do is they know pretty much what to feed you based on what our needs are. And if we paid more attention to them, we would do better. But the people that we really need are called physician nutrition specialists, which is it's a degree that actually exists, but it's not certified. It doesn't have a special certification that gives them a title that people respect, which is a shame, because these are internists and endocrinologists and pediatricians who take 1 or 2 years of nutritional medicine. And there were at one time about 15 or 20 different centers in the U.S. that were producing these people. But we need to go back to doing that, because every hospital needs to have a whole staff of physician nutrition specialists to try and supervise what we eat and what kind of support we give in the way of vitamins, minerals, and nutrients to people who are sick.
I remember one time you had a patient in that was really, really sick, and he had a feeding tube because he wasn't able to swallow.
Right.
And they were giving him Ensure, and this guy was having chronic diarrhea. Just, you know, he was miserable. And you asked about and the family was very cooperative and wanting to help and everything, eager to help. And so you suggested that maybe they juice, you know, give them some juices
through the tube.
That's like juices. We're talking about vegetable juice.
Yeah, real food.
And put that through the tube.
Right.
And when the other doctors found out and the nurses, everybody was just up in arms. They were all upset that we wanted to give them real food instead of Ensure.
Well, I tried to get the people in the kitchen to do it as well. And they said, oh, well, you know, we can't juice. And I said, why not? You can buy a juicer and you can do that. And that's the best.
Except the family was even willing to do it, though. And they made this big stink. And I remember saying to you in the background while you were talking to this doctor that was in charge of that floor or something. And I said, you know, patients bring See's candy or other kinds of candy into patients all the time. You know, and so you told that to the doctor and then he shut up. And the family brought the guy the juice and put that in the tube, and guess what? His diarrhea stopped.
Yeah, so and he got a lot better. This was a guy who had had strokes on both sides of his body at age 37 from problems that had to do with clots forming in his heart and then going up to his brain. And he walked out of the hospital. It was unbelievable. It was one of the most amazing cases I'd seen. But the bottom line here is it was really the chief of staff of medicine. We said, Len, what are you doing? You know we can't do that. And I said, well, why, Rick, can't we do that? I said, is there something magic about having a juicer in the hospital? And he said, well, you know, we're not geared to do it, so why don't you just cool it? And I said, you know, this is my patient, and you're giving him something called Ensure that's got crap in it, basically. It doesn't have much in it. It's high fructose corn syrup, and it even at that time, I think, had trans fats in it. It was like, what are we doing? The nutrition that we have, that we deliver to our patients, is absolutely vital for their recovery. So he permitted me to do that when Vicky's idea of mentioning that it'd be okay to bring in See's candy. But their point was, how could we trust what food was being brought from the outside? It was okay to bring in See's candy, but it wasn't okay to bring in food from the outside from juicing. You know, juicing is the most effective way of providing the best nutrition on the planet that there is.
Because it's concentrated. All the nutrients are concentrated in the juice.
Well,
and you can intake a lot more that way than if you ate the whole vegetable. We're not saying it's not good to eat the whole vegetable, but if you're in a situation where you're not able to eat that much vegetable and you're sick, I mean, this is what they do at the Gerson Clinic and other places, too, to help people that have cancer.
Well, you can consume about 20 pounds of vegetables a day in the form of juice, because it only makes about 6 or 8 glasses of juice. You couldn't possibly eat all the fiber that makes up the volume from something like that, particularly if you're sick. But if you've got a tube going into your stomach and you're being fed with something like Ensure, This is the best thing that you could possibly provide because it's what Mother Nature makes. I think normally I don't advise my patients to juice because they don't need juicing. What they need is any more than they need the fiber that's in the food. So I tell them if they can eat a lot of vegetables and not overcook them, it's the best way to get nutrition. If you're really sick and you need concentrated nutrition and you have to have 4 to 8 glasses of juice a day, you're going to need 15 or 20 pounds of vegetables to do that. And in that case, when they're really sick, I give it to them. So there are people who have cancer, for example, or immune deficiencies or other severe life-threatening diseases that can be treated with juicing. I went to the Gerson Clinic that Vicki's talking about in Tijuana.
Just to try it out.
About 10 years ago to see what it was like. And I met all the patients that were there and was very impressed with what they did from that point of view. Now, I don't agree with a lot of what the Gerson protocol is because I think it's old. You know, it's what Max Gerson designed about 100 years ago now, and his daughter Charlotte now is bringing forth that kind of treatment still, and it's a wonderful program in general. But I think there are new things as well that we've learned that should be added to it. But the juicing part is just stellar because it's important.
It's not easy to do the juicing.
No,
particularly when people are sick, because it is
like
very time-consuming.
Well, you wind up spending a couple of hours in the morning, and you really should have a juicer that's a press as opposed to one that has centrifugal force. So you're looking at spending somewhere between $1,500 and maybe $3,000 to buy a professional juicer that will take that fiber out, so what's left is the great nutrition. Now, there's nothing wrong with having fiber, too, if you can eat it, but people who are sick generally don't like that. They can't consume that much food. In fact, they don't have appetites. So you have to titrate them to be able to take a little bit more in the way of juice before you try to, you know, give them too much.
Well, personally, I like to use I have a vitamin mixer, mm-hmm. but there are other brands that are advertised on TV all the time, and that way I get my fiber. Of course, I don't have cancer. I'm not sick with anything, and I'm trying to stay healthy, and I think it's difficult to get in like 5 to 7 servings of vegetables a day.
Well, sometimes it is, but I mean, when you make your juice, you're probably getting 15 different kinds of vegetables a day. You put all kinds of good things in there that are really healthy. I mean, what are some of the things you put in your juice in the morning, Vicki?
Well, I put in lots of different green vegetables, and I also have a green powder that I like to use, and flaxseed oil, and then I add chia seeds, and I add pumpkin seeds and other types of acai powder I have, and different things like that. I put ginger in there. I'm trying to remember all the things that I put
in there.
Well,
there's sure a lot of things I know there. Anyway, that's a good way to go. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here at Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines now. If you have any questions about your health or what we're talking about, at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. So give us a call or send us an email if you have a question about your health or what we're talking about. And now it's time for Vicki's first 2020 tip on Eat, Drink, and Be Merry, and to be followed by Why Acupuncture is Next by Mainstream Medicine.
Listen carefully now. The Japanese eat very little fat, and they suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or the Americans. On the other hand, the French eat a lot of fat and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or the Americans. Now, the Japanese drink very little red wine, and they suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or the Americans. And the Italians drink excessive amounts of red wine and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. So what do you think is the solution? Well, the conclusion is to eat and drink what you like. It seems that speaking is it what kills you?
That's really probably true. You know, I hate to admit it because occasionally I like what Dean Adel does. And he did write a book by this title, Eat, Drink, Marry. He has a great book. I mean, what we eat varies so much in different countries. And the fact that we have problems no matter what we eat sometimes or do better no matter what we eat sometimes depends on a lot of other factors. It happens to our attitude. How do we feel about life? Are we anxious or depressed? All these things affect the nutrition that we absorb from our food.
You know, the other thing, when you were talking about the juicing, part of the digestive process is to chew your food. There are enzymes that help digest your food. So,
and to be present with your food before that. They're called secretagogues, meaning that when
secretagogues.
That's what they're called. So that when you smell the food and you're present with it, your stomach starts adjusting to make what you need to be able to digest food and to absorb it. So it's a really good thing. So I think that there was a study that was done in about 1980 that compared how well people absorbed what they ate. And they gave one group organic food cooked and boiled or however it was done, but it wasn't that tasty, but it was healthy for you. And they gave another group greasy food and all kinds of things that were with it, and then they measured nutritional levels afterwards. The people that ate with gusto and felt good about what they ate absorbed their food better than those people who were just doing their duty to try and eat the right things that didn't taste so good. So there's a lot involved in this eat the memory stuff. It makes a good point.
So what's the title, acupuncture has limited benefit for chronic pain? I mean, acupuncture has been around for 5,000 years. Because Western medicine doesn't practice it, well, doctors are hesitant to recommend it, or they write it off as placebo. I mean, does science in a way of common sense?
You're talking about an article published in Archives of Internal Medicine, okay, just this last week or so, that by Sloan Kettering scientists, they reviewed the 29 studies that they selected that they said were the best ones. It included 18,000 patients who had been treated with acupuncture. And basically, they implied that acupuncture wasn't the first choice that they would use, that it might be of some value in some settings. The way they did the study is they had one group that would have acupuncture. It was real acupuncture. Another group would have acupuncture that was sham acupuncture, meaning no needles were actually inserted that were in the right place. And another group that was just in the control group. And what they found was that 50% of people who had regular acupuncture treatments had about 50% of their symptoms reduced. So half of the people benefit from it, and they had about a 50% improvement rate. There were 43% that got better with sham acupuncture, and 30% that were just in a placebo. Now, that tends to really tell you that they're throwing out the thing called placebo, and saying that it's something that it shouldn't be looked as something that's real. But
the doctors in the studies are admitting that it helps the chronic back pain and joint pain and headache and shoulder pain. But they say that some of the benefit is likely due to the placebo effect. But if so, so what?
Yeah, well, that's right. And then they go on and say that it's reasonably expensive and it costs about $100 in treatment, and that many insurances don't cover it. So what they're going to suggest is that they use that doctors recommend drugs first. And I'm going, well, let's see now. If you talk to acupuncturists and ask them what kind of results they'll get, they'll say at least 75% of their people get better. And these are usually people that have been doing all the other things that their doctors have prescribed, and they're still in pain. So they're taking a refractory people, and they're getting good results. Now, that's an important thing to appreciate. Because that's what we're looking at. And the fact that there are no problems with acupuncture, I mean, how many people die every year from acupuncture treatment, Vicki?
Well, I haven't heard of any.
No, I haven't either. How many people die from NSAIDs, things like Advil?
About 30,000.
Yeah, and maybe 300,000 hospitalization. And how about the drugs that are even a little bit more potent than that? You look at some of those, and you're looking at massive amounts of problems from the drugs that are called TNF-alpha inhibitors that are used for people who have refractory pain. So the drugs include Humira, Enbrel, Remicade, and Simponi.
But what about some of these placebo-controlled studies that Western medicine does? And what about, like, antidepressants, for example? They did studies and showed that placebo effect is just as powerful as antidepressants. They've also done that with exercise.
It was the same. If you get a drug in the mainstream, okay, that is being evaluated, you are going to be looking at it a lot differently than people who are looking at drugs that have that are complementary and alternative, or chemicals or nutrients complementary and alternative. So we have to be fair about looking at the effect of placebo. If you have just a 5% improved benefit from a drug over a placebo, the FDA will approve it, because all it has to do is be statistically significant. And then you're looking at all the side effects that go with it. And in that group of drugs I was talking about, the TNF-alpha inhibitors, you're looking at over a 5-year period, 1 in 33 people dying from it. They may get only a 25 to 50% benefit from it. And there are all kinds of problems with infection, other side effects that are massive, and our rheumatologists are pouring it out like candy to some of their patients. I mean, I think it's criminal to be looking at things like acupuncture in settings like that, because it's safe, has a long track record, doesn't hurt anybody, and often does things that are rather remarkable.
Well, acupuncture tends to treat the cause of the pain rather than just treating the pain, you know, symptomatically. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to bring up here that the reason that I had my first acupuncture treatment was because my friend told me that it helped her horse.
Yeah.
I was thinking at the time, this was many, I don't know, 30-something years ago, mm-hmm. and I was thinking at the time maybe it was placebo, because, you know, I was into Eastern medicine and wasn't doing much of alternative things in those days. And I thought, well, if it helped the horse, maybe it would help me, because I was able in my mind to get rid of the fact that maybe it was a placebo effect on the horse. But who knows, you know, maybe it could have that effect. But I've had several acupuncture treatments, and another time that I went, I'd had a headache for 2 weeks, let up, and he took care of my headache immediately when I had the acupuncture treatment.
Well, what have we learned since 1970? You know, that's when Nixon visited China, and through their public relations, he brought a video showing somebody having an operation, only having acupuncture needles inserted a few places in the body, particularly in the neck. And this person was eating an orange during the surgery and had nothing else, and it was a major abdominal surgery. So we're talking about something here that has an amazing power. And I thought at that time, wow, that means that we're not going to have to use anymore these toxic drugs that kill a few people, have lots of side effects, and lead even some brain problems in some people.
Well, gee, maybe we'll have to start having them catered.
Yeah, well, that's right. Some people
eat what they want. Surgery. Yeah.
Well, isn't it absurd that this has never made it to the mainstream? It's like people thinking about, we should get on with what the future offers
well,
us.
Well, it's because how many times medicine. People put down things that they're not familiar with.
Well, that's right. It's time for our FM station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Soder here with Nurse Vicki. The lines are open at 888-874-4888. We'll be right back. Listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. If you have a question about your health, give us a call.
A high-fat diet can reset our metabolism and prevent obesity? According to new research, lower body weight, in other words, we can weigh less if we're on a scheduled high-fat diet than an unscheduled low-fat diet with the same number of calories. So how does this work?
Well, let's talk about what a scheduled versus an unscheduled diet is. If you eat at regular times as opposed to just when you feel like it, there's a big difference in how the metabolism of the body works. Now, this particular article was published in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and what it showed is that if you scheduled people and gave them a high-fat diet as opposed to a low-fat diet and gave the same number of calories, amazingly, you'd lose more weight on the high-fat diet. Now, this was done on mice, but nonetheless, this was done over 18 weeks, and it was compared to three different programs. One was a scheduled low-fat diet, the other was an unscheduled low-fat diet, and the other was a diet that was scheduled and high-fat. Now, we know from a few weeks ago, we reported an article that was in the journal Cell Metabolism that showed again in rats that if you feed them over 8 hours as opposed to over 24 hours with the same number of calories, those rats that were in the 8 hour separate or part of that had less weight gain than people who were fed over 24 hours. And you may say, well, what's going on there? What's happening?
Well, doesn't the study say that then the fat's not stored but used for energy when there's no food that's available?
Well, it is, but it has to do with different kinds of circadian rhythms. These are the rhythms that direct how much of a hormone is going to be secreted at what time of the day. For example, when you're measuring cortisol, which is made by the adrenal glands, it's high in the morning, it drops in the afternoon. And that kind of pattern affects how metabolism works and what you're going to burn for fat and how much you're going to store. So the message of this study is don't eat between your meals. It's okay to have fat long as you're having the same number of calories, because if you do, chances are that you're going to weigh less.
Well, sometimes people recommend that people eat small, frequent meals.
Well, that's not going to work so well from this point of view. Now, if people are trying to gain weight, okay, small frequent meals. Okay.
I know when I'm home, I eat a lot more frequent meals.
Well, that's right. And what happens? Does your weight go up?
Yeah.
You know, so if you stayed on your scheduled diet and didn't have much in the way of snacks, you're probably going to do a lot better. I mean, you may want to have a piece of fruit in the afternoon or something like that to keep you going, or just to entertain you because food is fun. But from the point of view of how you're going to do,
fat's more satisfying. And I've noticed that, like, if I eat something that has fat in it in a meal, that I'm not as hungry again later.
It holds you longer because
if I think, oh, well, I'm not going to eat so much fat, and I'm going to, you know, then I start getting hungry later.
Well, so it's the carbs, see, that are the problem. You eat too many carbohydrates, what happens is that you wind up eventually making the pancreas do more work, because as you do that and the body gets stressed in terms of making insulin, which is absolutely necessary to be able to drive the sugar that's in our bloodstream into our cells where we can burn it, we have problems. In fact, that's what leads to this so-called metabolic syndrome, where we have higher and higher levels of insulin being secreted by the pancreas in an effort to override this problem that we have of driving sugar from the bloodstream into our cells.
You know, last night after reading this article, I was my stomach was growling. It was kind of late. My stomach was growling, and I remembered what Dick Cunningham told us one time. It was about how to have a spoonful of peanut butter before you go to bed.
Yeah, it helps you sleep.
We had some almond butter, so I had a teaspoon of almond butter. My stomach stopped growling, and I did go to sleep.
Well, maybe it worked. You know, one thing people don't realize is that we burn fat in our normal resting state. The only time we really burn sugar preferentially is when we're exercising really hard. You drive yourself to hard exercise, you'll get to a place where your body will shift from burning fat to burning carbohydrate, and that's when lactic acidosis builds up, and we start going into anaerobic metabolism, and we get tired. So when you do the test that tells you, it's called a bioenergy test, that tells you how much fat you're burning, or what you're burning as your primary fuel, you get this kind of information.
So scheduling meals sounds like it could be therapeutic to prevent obesity, and this is a good thing for doctors to know too.
Well, it's that fat isn't the bad thing.
Last week even we were talking about how coconut oil reduces belly fat.
Well, it can. See, some of the saturated fats are very good. The problem, in fact, you can't live without saturated fat. You need that to be able to make cholesterol, cell membranes, neurotransmitters, which are all absolutely vital to our body. So we have to consume that. What you don't want are trans fats, because those are the fats that cause arteriosclerosis and all the problems that go with it. So we should be consuming a certain amount of animal fat or saturated fats like coconut oil that are good quality oils in order to keep us healthy. And then we'll do a lot better. So this business of a fat phobia that we have in this country is way overdone. And when that happens, it gets us to doing things that turn out to be fad diets. I mean, even the, as Vicky said earlier in her tip, does it matter what you eat so much? Because you can
if
be
you
healthy.
Speak English.
Well, yeah, well, there you go. So that's what we're talking about to a large extent. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. It's time for Vicky's 2020 health tip. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicky, and her tip is going to be on every little bit of toxic exposure adds up, and that'll be followed by how prescription happy is the U.S., and finally, is it safe to use NSAIDs if you have heart problems?
To discourage exposure to toxins, and it's a story to help you to get the fact that every little toxin counts. So I was relating a story to an environmental doctor about my friend who did something that I commented on how it was toxic to her, and her response was, well, we're exposed to so many toxins anyway, what's one more? And what this doctor told me was a story that he tells his patients so that they can get it. That there was a village in a valley below a big dam, and the dam had a big tall wall. And every time it rained, the water collected in the dam. In the meantime, the water level continued to rise until one day the water began to overflow, and the people were just astonished, saying, you know, we've had lots of heavy rainstorms, and today we just had a little one, and the dam overflowed. You know, and as the water spilled over, the dam broke. So there's a fine line between wellness and disease, and we often think that we're cheating disease, but it'll catch up with us and without a healthy lifestyle.
You're right. You know, it's like we use up our buffer between perfect health and the disease starts. I call that the wellness buffer. And we have a huge reserve when we're younger. Until about age 30, we cheat disease. After age 30, disease cheats us. And it's because we're gradually using up this wellness buffer that protects us. There's a big space between the best biochemistry you can possibly have, the best metabolism there is, and where we start to lose function and start to have symptoms. There's a huge gap there. So when we use that up, that's when we get into trouble and disease starts to cheat us. It's a big problem. It's a good tip. Thank you, Vicky.
The United States is prescription happy. I mean, patients must be happy to leave their doctor's offices with a prescription to fix their symptoms, because the U.S. filled over 4 billion prescriptions last year. That's $227 billion, and they continue to be on the rise. We spend more on prescription drugs than any other country, and they don't even come close. So, you know, these direct-to-consumer ads, I figure they have to be working.
Well, you're right. I mean, These are huge things, and what we see every year is increase in the amount of drugs that are being sold in various countries. There's a report that comes out every few months. It's called the World Pharmaceutical Market Summary. What it shows is, for example, in its last report, that sales are up 4% in North America. In Europe, they're up 2%. In Japan, 3%. In China, 19%. In Latin America, 25%, and Australia, 5%. So we're looking at huge changes in how we're depending on drugs to be able to solve the health problems that we really could solve by using lifestyle, but don't, because we've been convinced by the pharmaceutical industry through the ads and the direct-to-consumer ads that we need what they make.
Well, what are the top five drug types?
Well, those are really the cholesterol pills. The statins are the best-selling drugs, and those
the purple are pills, the indigestion pills.
Well,
pills.
Yeah, but the statins are things like Lipitor and Crestor and Mevacor and Pravacol and Lescol, and then you're looking at the anti anti-ulcer drugs like you're talking about, things like Acifex and Nexium. These are the purple pills, Prilosex and Protonix. Those are second. Third are antidepressants, so things like Celexa and Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft. And believe it or not, the fourth best-selling class of drugs are antipsychotic drugs. I mean, that doesn't surprise me too much because we are psychotic in how we depend on drugs. We shouldn't be doing that so much. You're talking about these Abilify ads? I mean, there are direct-to-consumer ads.
So what's the difference? Okay, so why don't you define the difference between antipsychotic and an antidepressant?
Well, antidepressants are just for depression. Antipsychotics is when you hallucinate or you have bipolar disease or you mean schizophrenia. You're talking about big diseases here, and a lot of them are used off-label. So you're talking about Abilify and Risperdal and Geodon and Haldon and Zyprexa and Seroquel and others. I mean, the fact that they're in the fourth best-selling place says a lot about
direct-to-consumer
how
ads.
Clever the pharmaceutical industry is to try and convince us that we need those drugs. And what's in fifth place? Things that are antihypertensive drugs, things like lisinopril and Avapro and Cozar and those. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them.
And what about the drugs for ADD? Those are on the rise, too.
Well, they are, and they're talk about overuse. I mean, it's massive overuse. Then you look at the individual drugs that are the best sellers. What's the best-selling drug in the world? Lipitor. And what's next? Plavix, that anticoagulant that we use so often for people who have stents or are at risk for developing clots that can lead to heart attacks and strokes. And then it's the purple pill, Nexium. I mean, all those things are way overused. And Seretide, these are the drugs, Vicki, the individual drugs that people take, not just the drug classes. So we're looking at individual drugs. And then there's the inhalants for asthma. And lastly, Crestor. So we're looking at a lot of drugs here that are used in massive amounts by the community.
You know, it's interesting. People are afraid to not take the statins when their doctors tell them to. But I'll tell you, if you want to learn about statins and the downside to them, check them out on our website. Just put that in the search box on drsaputo.com.
Well, that's right. What we really need is some kind of healthcare reform. What we've had so far is not healthcare reform. What we've had is economic reform. When I talk about healthcare reform, I'm talking about shifting the paradigm from disease care to healthcare, because what we have is a system that is perpetuating that we're sick and that we depend on doctors and drugs and technologies and surgeries.
And the other thing that's going on is that the pharmaceutical companies are busy inventing all these new drugs as the patents expire. The patients think that they're really special, new, updated drugs, when in fact what's going on is that the patient is the guinea pig for a new drug.
Well, that's right.
The drugs are being tested on you because if you're going to take a drug, it's probably better to take one that's been on the market for a long time, because you already know that it's still on the market.
I know. Well, see, when I was going through my training particularly, I was always wanting to know what the new drugs were, because I thought for sure they must be better, because why would people come out with another drug if we didn't need it? But that was naive thinking, and it turned out to be absolutely wrong. I mean, why do we have 10 different kinds of NSAIDs or 10 different kinds of drugs that lower cholesterol? On occasion, there are minor differences between them, but in general, there are a lot of lookalike drugs that aren't necessary, because there's a competitive market. When you have a patent that runs out, you've got to make something else in order to be able to be profitable, because drug companies are in business to make a return on investment.
And when we talk about these ads too, I think in a lot of ways what they're doing is they're just touting the placebo effects, you know, subconsciously telling.
Well, a lot of it is, but you know, in the case of statins, for example, we're using those. A lot of doctors are using that for primary care, which means used in people who have never had a atherosclerotic problem or a cholesterol issue. And that's the wrong thing to do. And that happens with a lot of drugs way too often. We do the same thing with the purple pill. We way overuse it. The fact is, the purple pill is only approved by the FDA for use up to about 8 weeks. If we use it longer than 8 weeks, we start getting into the complications where we have deficiency in digesting food.
Rebound symptoms, huh?
You get rebound symptoms if you go off of it that make you think that you need to be on it. And you can't afford vitamin B12 or calcium or iron. And so you wind up with problems with malnutrition. The risk of senile dementia goes up 18%. The risk of osteoporosis after a few years goes up 45%. So these are things that should not be taken casually. And then to put people on antipsychotic drugs, I mean, that to me is just too much. You start treating ADD kids with antipsychotic drugs. I mean, there was a doctor at Harvard, a guy named Joseph Biederman, a few years ago, who there was a scandalous report because he had a connection with the pharmaceutical industry that was paying for his research, paying for the buildings he was putting at Harvard in order to treat these kids who had ADD, and saying what they really had was manic depressive problems. And it was like it was being so overdone. It's overdone enough to talk about people having problems with ADD, because 5-10% of the population of kids is on these drugs, and then to say that they need to be on antipsychotics as well is just unbelievable. So these kinds of things get way overdone. You've got to give credit to the pharmaceutical companies that can convince doctors and convince us that we need the drugs they make, and that the newer ones that are coming out, we need it more. And like Vicki said, it's really dangerous to be taking drugs like that.
Okay.
Because untested, we test them ourselves, because that's what's happening. There isn't that much research that's being done to get people to test people to find out how safe things are. So we find out when we bring them to market in massive amounts.
So these are drugs that are prescription drugs.
Right.
And earlier we touched on the NSAIDs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Think about it. If a drug is sold over the counter, do people just assume that it's safe? And then what about these NSAIDs? I mean, many people think that it's okay because they're not narcotics. So we're going to talk about why people who've had a heart attack should never take an NSAID.
Well, there was a lot of research done on this. It's really kind of stunning because it lets you know just how dangerous this is. We're not talking about drugs that. I mean, this research that was done in the journal Circulation looked at heart attack survivors who took NSAIDs, which they did about 44% of the time, and then looked at increased risk of death or second MI, and what they found was, and of stroke as well. And what they found was is that all-cause mortality at 1 year went up 59%.
That's huge.
It's an enormous number. And the risk of heart attacks went up between 30% and 40%. So you're looking at something that's not a small issue here. I mean, two drugs were taken off the market because of this, Vioxx and Bextra. And you tell me why Celebrex was left on the market, or why Advil or any of these other drugs that are non-steroidals are left on the market.
Well, they have to wait. It's just like with the stop sign. I guess they have to wait for more people to die. I mean, with 30,000 deaths a year and 300,000 hospitalizations just from anybody taking them. And then now we're adding this. If you've already had a heart attack, then it increases your death rate even more.
I remember talking about this on KGO Radio in San Francisco with Ed Baxter, which get interviewed there from time to time. And it was about NSAIDs and what we do for pain. And I made the statement that I thought they should be taken off the market. And I felt strong about it. And another doctor was listening. He was on the show, a guy named Dean Adele. And he got incensed by it. He said, well, what are we supposed to do? So he called up Ed Baxter, and he said, I'd like to have a debate with Dr. Saputo about this on the Gene Burns Show, which we did. And I thought, why would somebody want to do that? Basically, the position that we're taking is, well, what do we do for pain if we have pain? We have to do something. And I said, well, if you think that it's okay for 30,000 people to die every year and for 300,000 to go in the hospital, then go ahead and take the NSAIDs like water. But in my opinion, there are many other ways to treat pain. And I would rather use a narcotic, okay, that doesn't have these side effects, that doesn't cause or near the same number of deaths than something like that. And, of course, the audience agreed with me. So it's interesting that we get our minds made up that a certain kind of treatment is okay just because the FDA has approved it, and because there's a conflict of interest between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry, they often get their way.
So let's remind people about some of the dangerous side effects are, or adverse effects when people take some of these NSAIDs, like besides heart attacks and strokes.
Oh, we're talking about ulcers and GI bleeds, about renal failure. Even erectile dysfunction is increased to 40%. That might get people's attention more than these other things because they think it's not going to happen to them.
Well, darling, I have a headache tonight.
Yeah, right.
Oh, take an NSAID. Whoops.
I don't think so.
That's and then also we talked earlier about leaky gut syndrome, so they contribute to that too.
Well, it also offsets the anticoagulant effect of aspirin. So if you take an NSAID like Advil and you take aspirin, you lose the anticoagulant effect. A major challenge here to manage what we do for pain. And that's what leads me back to looking at things like acupuncture and DMSO and body work of different
kinds. The photon stimulator.
Well, yeah, that's like magic. I mean, the fact that the photon stimulator is not a mainstream of medicine after I've been using it for 13 years really blows my mind. This is such a powerful way to manage pain, but it doesn't just manage pain. I mean, it's very effective at managing pain, but it increases circulation and it reduces inflammation. It speeds up healing by 50% according to NASA studies. It increases lymphatic drainage and it boosts immunity. So it does a lot of things that are really good for us, and it doesn't work over a period of weeks to months. It works right now. So if somebody comes into the office with a neuropathy from diabetes, for example, in 15 minutes, that person is likely to walk out of the office with the pain gone and with much of the numbness improved so that they have better balance and feel better. And we did a clinical trial on this at the VA local here on 120 patients to show that's the case. And they're now involved in research at the University of California in San Francisco with a $7 million grant from the National Institutes of Health, where we're looking at using this for people with therapy-induced nerve damage. But it's used for all kinds of things. You're talking about pain from discs or from sports injuries, carpal tunnel problems or repetitive stress injuries. Almost any kind of pain is... And the healing is sped up.
And you don't have the side effects that you do with an NSAID.
No, nobody's died from infrared light therapy.
And also, like you said, it's good for inflammation. And we all know that inflammation is not a good thing. And a lot of people assume that taking an anti-inflammatory drug is a good thing to do. And then you actually,
well, it might be if it didn't have these problems.
Well, yeah. But there are other things that are helpful for inflammation besides the
sure.
You talked about acupuncture and so forth, but ice, sometimes heat, sometimes mm-hmm. chiropractic, all those.
Oh, the body work, yeah. I mean, there's a
helpful.
Wide range of things, and what we should be doing is look at integrative approaches.
But also, advertising on TV, they entice people to think that they're a good parent if they give it to their child. And I think people need to be aware that this is dangerous thing to do, and you your child feels sick and they don't feel good or whatever, maybe that's part of the process. Maybe it's a good time to just be with them and snuggle them, or you know, give them some comfort food or some broth or whatever it is. But I mean, sometimes there's a reason to have a fever. You have to always bring down
there's
a
always
fever.
A reason to have a fever, and it's a good thing unless you get to a level where it can induce a seizure in a kid. Otherwise, it's doing things. The body's reacting in a normal physiological way.
But they're off like candy in hospitals. They really are.
I mean, look at the damage, okay, that is done by these NSAIDs. There were about 1,000 deaths over the 10 years that we were involved in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. And that's looked at as a major disaster.
How many have died?
Well, about 8,000 deaths from that. And when you look at the number of deaths that there have been from NSAIDs, it's 30,000 a year times 10 years. That's 300,000 deaths.
Instead of going to war, we should just take those NSAIDs and give them to the enemy.
There you go. We get free drugs. Okay, but